Western civilization has influenced the way the world works, thinks, and governs itself. Most people now live or aspire to live in a manner that's an invention of the West. Yet only 400 or 500 years ago, the nations of Western Europe hardly indicated their future greatness, especially when compared to Imperial China or the Ottoman Empire. So, what did it take for the West to transform itself into being so dominant and the standard of modern civilization? And what, if anything, threatens that historical dominance today? Neil Ferguson, a professor of history at Harvard University, was on our show last month to discuss Civilization, the West and the Rest, his latest book, which seeks to answer those questions. It was a fascinating conversation, and we thought we would re-air it for you today. I asked him, don't the Western countries represent more than just a geographical definition? How would you define what you mean by the West?
Well, the West is certainly more than a geographical expression. Of course, it originated geographically in Europe and spread not only across the Atlantic but as far afield as Australasia. And it was a complex of institutions and ideas. What I'm really trying to get at when I talk about Western civilization is the way those institutions and ideas evolved from the late 15th century. There was some considerable debt to the first version of Western civilization, the classical civilization of ancient Greece and Rome, but that wasn't really the crucial thing. It wasn't those ancient legacies that propelled the West to dominance after 1500. It was the new ideas and institutions that came in that period that I focus on in the book.
Well, the Renaissance represented a kind of rediscovery of the old ideas, didn't it?
It did, and a rediscovery of ideas that had often only been preserved in the non-Western world, in the Islamic world. But what's interesting...
But like Borges wrote, we're all Greeks, meaning that we are a social, scientific, and cultural evolution to the method used and developed by the Greek philosophers.
This is right, and I don't want to in any way diminish that the importance of that classical legacy, but I'm not sure that it was that which propelled the West into a position of such extraordinary dominance that by the 20th century one could really say the world was ruled by the West. I mean, it was the new ideas that came in the 15th, 16th, 17th century that I think really changed the game. For example, the scientific revolution of the 17th century does much, much more than just revive what had been known in the time of Aristotle. It completely changes the way that we think about the natural world and the way that we try to find out about it, the experimental method and the way that findings are disseminated. That's all new, and it's absolutely crucial.
Although they also represented the decline of other dominant areas. For example, the Arabic world was the leader in mathematics and science, and then it went into decline, and the West kind of picked up the baton.
Yeah, that's something that fascinates me, because in some ways, although it's tempting to think of civilizations clashing, that's a term that I think of Sam Huntington using, in fact, often these civilizations didn't collide. It was the collapse of one civilization that, so to speak, opened the door for the advent or the arrival of the West. I mean, the West didn't have to do an awful lot to cause the Inca and the Aztec empires to collapse. Disease did most of the work. And similarly, the weakness of Mughal India or of Ming China, later of Qing China, was something that was endogenous. It wasn't that they were caused to collapse by Western intervention. They were already in various ways somewhat fragile. So this is a story which is as much about non-Western civilization as about Western civilization. I very nearly called the book Civilization plural, but decided that might just muddy the water.
But didn't the Chinese government collapse largely because the British came in and imposed what they said was free trade, actually the selling of opium on China against its best wishes?
The official version of Chinese history, which you will get if you go to the National Museum in Beijing, is precisely that a century of humiliation began with the Opium Wars, the British interventions, and continued until the Glorious Revolution of 1949. Well, it wasn't quite that straightforward. It's obvious that the British are nibbling at the edges of a system which has some pretty profound fragilities. And one reason it was possible for the rather thuggish Scotsman who took over Hong Kong to do that was that that China was not well set up in the 19th century to contend with the competitive companies that came along trying to monopolize the most lucrative parts of its trade. Adam Smith has a great line about this in The Wealth of Nations, which I think goes to the heart of what my book's about. He says, you know, why is it that China has appeared to stagnate for so long? It's reached a level of opulence, he says, that is consonant with its institutions and laws, and it's now in a stationary state because of those laws and institutions. I think that's right. I think what had happened to China, and it was something that happened in both the Ming and Qing eras, was that although the institutions worked in a certain way and they could sustain a very large population, a fifth of humanity...
Although they had a lot of civil wars
They sustained it at quite a low level, so that, the per capita income, as far as we can see from the most recent Chinese research, didn't go anywhere. It flatlined right the way through into the 19th century when it began to fall. And the system, this enormous centralized bureaucratic system, was prone to breakdown. And when rebellions happened, as they did spectacularly in the Taiping Rebellion, the results were absolutely devastating. More people die in the Taiping Rebellion than in the First World War, including all combatants. Now, you can try and blame that on Western intervention because the Taiping leader had in some way been influenced by a Western missionary, but it's a bit of a stretch. There's obviously something rather more unstable at the heart of the system than just Western intervention.
But when we talk about the West, we can talk about certain things like Western institutions. Democracy is very spotty in the West from the 15th century on, in through the 20th century. Is it the economics of Europe? Is it governmental structures?
Democracy is a word that I don't regard as crucial. It's not one of my killer apps, to use the jargon I use in the book. Because democracy, as you rightly say, comes relatively late in the story. I mean, most Western societies don't become democratic in the sense of having universal suffrage until the 20th century, and some quite late into it.
And we have many major dictatorships.
And there are all kinds of alternate models. I mean, the West is quite good at producing alternatives to democracy, whether communist or fascist, in the 19th and 20th centuries. So it's not that. It's really more the rule of law that is crucial. And I try to show that one of the killer apps, one of the key institutions, was the way in which the rule of law evolved in the English-speaking world to be concerned, above all else, with the protection of private property rights and establishing a link between those rights and a broader conception of freedom. Representative government emerges out of this notion of the law as a protector of property rights because the law has to be made by the property owners in some kind of assembly in which they're represented. And that happens in the English-speaking world. It doesn't happen in other parts of the West. And it turns out to be a tremendously potent social and political tool. So I compare North America and Central and South America, both settled by Westerners, by Europeans, but they go on completely divergent paths, mainly because in the North, a system of land distribution and a notion of liberty based on property evolves and flourishes. And in the South, most of the land is allocated to a tiny minority of conquistadors and their relations, and everybody else ends up landless. And that has very profound social and political consequences.
But that is the consequence of the Spanish and Portuguese empires. In a previous book you wrote, I'm fundamentally in favor of empire. Indeed, I believe that empire is more necessary in the 20th century than ever before.
Well, this is something that got me into a lot of hot water because...
That's why I brought it up.
Well, right. But people have a kind of incredibly allergenic reaction to the word empire and even more so imperialism, forgetting that most of the history of civilization is a history of empires. And what I try and do in this book is to explore once again the role, ambivalent role these empires played, but to point out, very important point, that empire was the least original thing that Europeans did after 1500. They were just doing what everybody did, both in the Western world and the non-Western world. They arrived.
The Chinese never really had an empire. They just simply had a vast country.
Ooh, now there's a wonderful assertion that you must know is untrue.
Well, the Chinese claim they're not expansionists, although people
that,
in Tibet might disagree.
They would say that, wouldn't they? And you should ask the Uyghurs, too. I mean, the reality is that the Chinese only relatively recently turned their empire into a unitary state and asserted the homogeneity of its Han ethnicity. In fact, China is an overland empire empire, which expands to the west, much as the Russian empire expands in the other direction till they finally meet. So I think we've got to be very careful of making the assumption, which is very commonly done, that there's something peculiarly Western about empire and imperialism. No, this is the normal way in which organizations evolve historically, and most of what we call history is ultimately concerned with these big units like empires and civilizations.
You say that most of the world's wealth was made after 1800 and that today most of it's owned by Westerners. Only 90% of the world's population, Westerners own two-thirds of its wealth.
19%.
Is that what I said?
Yeah, 19%. 19% of the population of the world, the people who live in the West, own about two-thirds, 66% of the private wealth. That's based on some recent figures from Credit Suisse. This is the legacy of the story I'm telling. I mean, the great divergence that happens from about 1500 and right the way into the 1970s, an exponential divergence of per capita income relative West relative to East, has left an enduring legacy of global imbalance. I mean, we talk about global imbalances all the time when we're talking about the financial crisis, but this is the real global imbalance, and it will take a long time to undo that.
Despite all of the predictions that China is about to take over.
Well, I try to explore that issue towards the end of the book because, obviously, a big question is, are we living through the end of Western predominance? And I think we are probably living through an end certainly to that era, because the great divergence is clearly over. I mean, what has happened since 1978 is that whereas then Americans were 20 times richer on average than the Chinese, today they're less than 5 times richer. And that's a remarkable compression in terms of average income. China's will probably be the biggest economy in the world within 5 years.
And India is growing very fast as well.
And India's projected to catch up with the United States by mid-century. Now, these projections are probably not worth the paper they're printed on, but I think it would be a mistake to bet against this trend because the demographic and other forces at work are very powerful. And I think this is the key argument I make in the book. What we see is one non-Western society after another, beginning with Japan, essentially copying the institutions that worked for the West. And that is essentially what China has done since 1978, with one notable exception. They're not going down our route of rule of law and representative government.
Well, in the case of Japan, they emulated a lot of the Western ideas, but not all of them, and that's caused them to have some serious problems today.
Or you could just say that Japan has so successfully downloaded our killer applications, including triumphing in the field of healthcare and greatly lengthening life expectancy, that they present a vision of the future for the rest of us, because they show what happens when your society ages to the point that a third of people are over 65 and your debt burden rises to the point that it's more than twice your national income. So, I mean, I think there's an interesting issue here about Japan, because Japan was the first non-Western society to get it and to become Westernized institutionally, not culturally. There's a big difference I want to make clear to listeners. I'm talking here about the way institutions can change behavior in quite different cultures. And I'm essentially arguing that the big shifts in economic power and in other forms of power happen mainly because of institutions and not because of long-standing cultures. And the things I'm talking about, whether it's competition in the economic sphere or the work ethic or the scientific revolution, you can make these things work anywhere. And ultimately, the Japanese were the first people to show that you did not have to be Western in order to make these institutions work for you.
As a historian, do you think that the West has lost its compass?
Well, I do, in the sense that I'm not sure we understand very well why we were so successful.
So do we have to look to the past for solutions to the current problems?
I certainly don't think you can solve many problems today without some historical understanding. And I think the first step to seeing what we need to change is to understand what worked so well before and ask what's gone wrong with it. I mean, I'll give you just one example. We think of this as a society in which the rule of law works well and that private property rights are well protected. But when you look at recent surveys like the one that the World Economic Forum does, the United States comes up very badly in terms of objective measures and also subjective measures of how well the rule of law works. It turns out that on 16 counts, the US isn't even in the top 20 of countries in terms of the efficiency and efficacy of the rule of law. And on 15 out of 16, Hong Kong is a long way in front. So that from the point of view of somebody, say, who wanted to start a business, it is in fact the case that it would be much better to do that in Hong Kong today than in New York. You would have far smaller burden in terms, for example, of what I might call the rule of lawyers. We had the rule of law once. I think we now have the rule of lawyers. And that's a different thing, which imposes all kinds of costs on people like entrepreneurs who are, in the end, the wealth creators.
In looking back, do you think that English and American historians have different perspectives?
I think there's a certain Atlantic divide, although if you take, for example, the debate on empire, which I have been much involved in, there's not a huge difference there. There's a very strong body of opinion in the academy that wants to tell the story of the Great Divergence in terms of imperial exploitation and terms of that sort, and to emphasize, to accentuate the negative. I think really that the problem with that is it's so unbalanced. If we tell our kids that the most important thing you need to know about Western ascendancy was slavery or famine, then much as those things need to be there, we're missing out the more important drivers of dramatic economic change that has not only greatly increased the prosperity of human beings, but increased their longevity. I mean, let's face it, it's Western civilization that massively increases life expectancy once the great 19th century breakthroughs happen in medicine. And I try to show, as a counterexample to the many people who've bashed me over the years about empire, how in places like Senegal, it was Western doctors and scientists who began to solve the problem of infectious disease that made that part of the world so dangerous to live in. And that does impact on life expectancy for Africa.
Well, there has been a terrible trade-off. It's come at the price of the environment in many places. The destruction of traditions in Congo and Rwanda and all over Africa, for example, or South America or Mesoamerica.
Well, I make it very clear that, for example, what happened in Belgium was a sort of appalling last manifestation of the slave plantation model of empire. And I dwell even more and at greater length on the story of what happened in German Southwest Africa, where you for the first time see racial theory applied to pursue genocidal policies against the tribes like the Herero peoples, like the Herero Nama. So this is a book that is as much concerned with these darker aspects of Western expansion as with the sunnier side.
My guest is Neil Ferguson, who is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University and the William Ziegler Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. He's a Senior Research Fellow at Jesus College, Oxford, and a Senior Research Fellow of the Hoover Institution in Stanford University. His latest book is called Civilization, the West and the Rest. It is published by Penguin Press. And when we come back, let's look at your six killer apps. We're back with Neil Ferguson, who was on our show in November to discuss his latest book, Civilization, the West and the Rest, and we're re-airing that conversation for you today. I asked him, didn't you do a TV series called Civilization?
That's right. It's not out here yet. It'll be on PBS in the new year.
Is this kind of the companion book?
They went side by side because I think with a television series you can reach an even larger audience than you can with a book. That's just a fact of life. And I actually find it quite creatively stimulating to work on the two things together. Apart from anything else, you get to go to places more than if you write a book in a conventional way. And it's often the encounters that I think give the book its vivid quality.
In 1500, the countries that went on to become the Western empires were quite tiny. By 1913, the Western countries controlled 58% of the world territory and three-quarters of global economic output. You say that the West developed six new concepts, what you are calling killer apps, maybe we should talk about them. That these are the reasons that the West became dominant?
Best I can.
And you use the word dominant, by the way.
It is dominance. I mean, certainly by the time you get to 1913, it's a Western-dominated world. That number, 75% of the global economy, actually understates it, because that's only the formal empires. The dozen Western empires control indirectly most of the economy of China and South America, even although they don't formally rule over those places. So it's dominance, all right. And the killer apps idea was just a way of making, I guess, my teenage children listen. If I'd said there are six complexes of ideas and institutions, they would have zoned out. So killer apps, well, everybody gets what an app is. It's something you download on your phone. It's simple looking. It's an icon. You tap it and it works. And the things I'm talking about have a simple quality to them to look at. When I say competition was a killer app, it sounds deceptively simple. In fact, what I'm talking about are very complex institutional differences between the West and the rest. The fact that there are multiple states in Europe in 1500, 100 or more. Plus, within these states, and this is the interesting part, there are lots of semi-autonomous corporate entities that kings don't really control. I give the example of the Corporation of the City of London, which is an autonomous mercantile body that runs the affairs of the city, and the king can't really control it. Things like that really didn't exist in other civilizations, and that's the ancestor of the modern corporation.
How much of a role did Protestantism play in all of this? Because competition was squelched before the Protestant Reformation.
Well, the Reformation is important in at least three ways in the story. First, because it shatters the monopoly of the Roman Catholic Church. Second, because it makes literacy something that matters. The whole idea Luther has that everybody should be able to read scripture for themselves is tremendously important, because once you can read the Bible in the vernacular, you can read anything. And the printing presses of Europe very quickly, of Northern Europe, of Central Europe, very quickly shift from just producing religious texts to producing all kinds of texts. And I don't think you can have a scientific revolution without that surge in literacy and the creation of a network of publication. The third Protestant contribution is the more controversial. That's Max Weber's idea that there's some kind of Protestant ethic which fuels capitalism. And I spend the last chapter exploring that idea. I don't think Weber was quite right about this. I don't think the work ethic was unique to Protestants, although I can see why he thought that after a trip to the United States in 1904. I think it turns out that the work ethic was pretty much there already in Jewish communities, and now, of course, it flourishes in Confucian culture in China.
And in the Italian Renaissance and in the Northern Renaissance. Which were both still driven by mostly by Catholics.
Yeah. So this is in this third respect, I basically give the verdict against Weber. It's not the work ethic, it's the word ethic with a D at the end that really counts.
Our second app is the scientific revolution. Now, China gave us paper and gunpowder and had some pretty sophisticated medicine. Wasn't it already fairly scientifically advanced?
Yes, and you could go further and say the Islamic world in the 10th century is streets ahead of Europe in terms of mathematics. Algebra is, after all, an invention of the Arabic world, comes from Al-Khabar. And the West lags behind and indeed has to import many of the ideas and technologies. Some even think that the way that we make textiles came from the Orient.
And but, the way we write numbers.
And the way we write numbers definitely came from the East and came back, as it were, came through to Europe through the Arabic world via trade. People like Fibonacci essentially get taught mathematics by Arabs. Now, that's all true, and this book makes that very clear. I mean, the whole point of the book is to point out at the beginning of the story how backward Europe is. But what happens in the course of the 17th century is a scientific revolution qualitatively different from anything that had happened in China or in the Muslim world, and it did not happen in any way whatsoever there. The scientific revolution is a purely European phenomenon, and although it's building on non-European foundations, it takes a quantum leap in the way that we understand everything from the movement of the planets down to the circulation of blood and the nature of matter itself. You know, the microscope is something that people like Hooke use in a revolutionary way. The way that we experiment, the experimental method. People like Galileo develop a whole new approach to doing science, where you have a hypothesis and you try to falsify it by repeated experiments. And then, of course, you have this revolution in the way that scientific ideas are shared. It hit me as I was writing this book that there's a wonderful network effect here, that all across Europe, learned men, some of them gentlemen scholars, others like Newton, formal academics, are exchanging ideas in an amazing network that allows, via publication or via correspondence, mathematical ideas and ideas about physics to be pulled, shared. And the ethos of the scientific revolution is publish, publish, publish. Get it out there. Don't keep anything secret. If you make a discovery, be the first to get it into print. And all of this is quite new, and it doesn't happen anywhere else.
Although Darwin was reluctant to publish his ideas because of the stir that it would cause.
But what prompted him to publish them? The realization that somebody else had had the exact same ideas and was about to beat him to the punch.
One of your other apps is property rights. Why was the right to own private property so important?
Well, of course, private property is not uniquely Western by any means, but the legal institutions governing the ownership of property and the political philosophy that grew out of those institutions, here we seem to have something quite distinctive. So I spent some time looking at the way English political thought evolves and exploring the nexus between the common law, the notion of Parliament as a place in which property is represented to make the law, and then this huge leap which John Locke makes that takes you from ownership of property to freedom more broadly defined. And Locke's argument in the Second Treatise of Government is that you come together as men in a commonwealth, in a state, in order to protect those property rights and the freedom associated with them. Now, this is an idea which is not that revolutionary in a society like England, where the distribution of property is pretty unequal. But when you start applying ideas like that in a new world, thinly settled by indigenous peoples, and you start carving up the land into 100-acre pieces and essentially granting it to newcomers, even if they arrive penniless, that's transformative. And so for me, the best answer to the question, why did North America do so much better than South America after European settlement, is the whole concept of property ownership and its significance, above all its political significance, is completely different in the North.
Although now we're seeing Brazil is one of the resurgent countries.
Well, right.
With these countries learning from the West, are we at a situation where we're likely to see more patents being developed in these new countries than we are here? The feeling is that they're surging ahead.
Yes, well, we are seeing more patents. I think I even have a chart in the book that shows that Japan has been in the lead for some time in terms of international patents by country of origin. South Korea recently surged into third place behind the United States. And China is about to overtake Germany to take fourth place. Now, there's a big argument in wonkish circles about the quality of patents. So don't take that as a completely compelling piece of evidence. Some of these patents might not be worth the paper they're written on. But when you then look at other evidence of the quality of innovation and scientific research, say citations in scientific journals, there you can see the first real sign that the massive Asian investment in research and development, the sheer number of people being put through PhD programs in hard sciences is paying off.
A few years back, people like Thomas Friedman were crowing that the world is flat. What do you see as the globalization situation?
I never bought that idea entirely, though I think Tom's image of a world which was a great deal flatter in terms of international inequality was right, that this is really all about the end of the Great Divergence if Chinese per capita GDP begins to move in the direction they're not quite catching up with ours. However, the critical point to notice is that this diminution of inequality between nations is coinciding with a significant widening of inequality within nations. Whether you're talking about China or the United States or European countries, a striking feature of our time is quite dramatic increases in inequality, taking the United States back to roughly where it was in 1929. So the world is certainly not very flat if you are a member of the notorious 1%. It's a long way down if you're a member of the 0.01% from your private jet at 35,000 feet to the people down in the bottom quintile who can't even get a good basic education.
And the gap is widening in this country. Can we reverse all of that? Can we have a new divergence?
I think we certainly can avoid being overtaken. I'm not a declinist. The book doesn't believe in cyclical theories of history in which people inexorably decline once they've reached the top of their game. I think if we revitalize our institutions, which worked pretty well once, then we can recapture some of the ground that we've been losing. But it does require a pretty comprehensive overhaul of everything that we do right the way across, from the basics of economic market competition to the way in which we educate our children in science. It's all doable, but there is a conspicuous lack of political will to do it.
Neil Ferguson's latest book is called Civilization, The West and the Rest. It's published by the Penguin Press. When can we expect to see the TV series?
That will be early, I can't say more precisely, early 2012 on PBS.
And thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, more of our favorite interviews from this fall, Anita Hill. Yes, that Anita Hill talks about why the current housing crisis is jeopardizing the American dream and setting many families across the country adrift. And then Lawrence Berggren on the three voyages that Christopher Columbus made after his first encounter with the New World in 1492. Also, Russell Banks discusses his latest novel, Lost Memory of Skin, plus a look at the dangers posed by the advent of the digital age, cybercrime, cyber warfare, and cyber industrial espionage. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from John Maria Giolini and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Happy holidays, and we will see you tomorrow.